Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, a show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by Minnesota Public Radio. Well, today it's a look at eating out in America with Ruth Reichel, editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. What's driving chefs these days? How are we diners changing? And where would Ruth Reichel eat if she could only have two meals in the whole country and they couldn't be at famous restaurants? Wine maverick Joshua Wesson shows us how low you can go. Good wine at $5 a bottle and under. Then it's exotic coffee house culture from the Austro-Hungarian Empire. We get a new take on food and lust from Men's Health magazine. And as always in the second half of the show, we're opening the lines for your calls. That number is 800-537-5252. So let's dive in with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Jane, Michael, I have a question. What are the rules for eating in VFW halls, you know, Veterans of Foreign Wars halls? Because as you travel around the country, you see these signs up on these buildings that say, you know, we serve lunch or we serve dinner. Do you have to be a member?
No, you don't. You can just be John Q. Public or Jane Q. Public and walk in to one of these wonderful, very old-fashioned VFW halls and get a great meal very inexpensively. There's one that Michael and I love in Hartford, Connecticut, that serves Polish food. And then there's one in Cranston, Rhode Island, called Mike's Kitchen, which serves absolutely great Italian food.
The great thing about Mike's Kitchen is that there is no sign whatsoever outside to indicate that they serve any meals at all.
So how are you supposed to know?
You're not supposed to know.
Intuitively.
Somebody has to tell you, and we're about to do so. So the great thing, I mean, it's just a VFW hall, but if you go there any time at lunch, any day during the week at lunch, or any evening at supper time, except those evenings when the VFW meets or the Boy Scouts meet, you will see the parking lot mobbed with cars, because this place is not a local secret. People from all around Cranston and Connecticut and Massachusetts know that Mike's Kitchen is really one of the great inexpensive Italian restaurants of the Northeast.
But it's kind of Italian slash Portuguese slash Rhode Island. I mean, there are some dishes that are specific to Rhode Island, like snail salad.
Snail salad?
Yeah, cold snail salad. And also stuffed quahog clams, which are called stuffies, are a real Rhode Island treat. I'd say that the majority of the menu is Italian.
Well, it's what Mike, the chef and proprietor, calls Depression Italian. He learned to cook at his mother's side. His mother cooked during the Depression, and it's making do with, you know, not the most expensive cuts of beef. For example, he told us that he goes through 100 pounds of tripe per week.
Wow.
This is a very popular dish on the Mike's Kitchen menu. And how many other restaurants can you find this? And it's delicious.
My favorite thing there was this big, creamy, soft block of polenta that was served with fennel-spiked sausages on the side and a homemade marinara sauce. It was really delicious.
Oh, boy. Are the pastas great?
The pastas are wonderful. They do, because, you know, Rhode Island is such a seafood-oriented state. It says the ocean state on their license plates. They do a seafood, what they call Diablo, I think we would call it Diavolo, of fresh-caught lobster, scallops, and shrimp over a bed of linguine with lots of garlic and lots of just good olive oil. And it is really, it's a portion enough for three people. But we have found that is true in Rhode Island. I think they have an inferiority complex because they're the tiniest state.
Yeah.
They serve the biggest portions of food that I have ever seen in any state Michael and I have eaten at.
But you're talking about, this is lobster and scallops in a VFW hall where it's cheap.
It's very inexpensive. I don't think it's possible to spend more than $15 for the most deluxe meal in the house. And what's great is if you want a drink with your meal, you can order a drink, but it's an entirely separate business operation in the same VFW hall. The veterans themselves run the bar. So your drink order is paid for separately, and the food comes from the kitchen separately.
And you can get great old-fashioned cocktails like sidecars or, you know, whiskey sours. And the whole ambiance of Mike's Kitchen is very 1958 patriotic, suburban patriotic. I mean, it looks like the den in our house before we remodeled it.
Except without, we don't have all those awards. You know, there are a lot of VFW trophies and awards and plaques and things to commemorate, you know, great events in American history. Jane, we didn't have a lot of those.
No, and we don't have as many American flags on our den.
And no offense, because you two are great cooks, but I just don't know that you have all of that food happening.
No way.
I thought
no
you were going to say we were great patriots.
Well, of course, that too. But thanks, guys.
You're welcome. Bye, Lynn.
Bye, Lynn.
If you're feeling fancy free, come wander to the world with me. And any place we chance to be will be our rendezvous. Two for the road.
Jane and Michael Stern have a new updated edition of their classic guidebook, Road Food. Now, every week you can hear them here on The Splendid Table, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just hit the website, splendidtable.org. Joshua Wesson is a wine expert and former sommelier who loves hunting down bargain wines. And he's a master at pairing wines with any food you can think of, from ribs to Twinkies. Josh, welcome back.
It's so good to be back.
So what have you been mulling lately?
Besides cider?
Well, yeah.
I've been mulling buying an apartment in New York. And if you've ever visited anyone who's mulled buying an apartment in New York, you know how sad and droop-faced and upset they are, because no matter how much money they put into that piggy bank, they never really make enough to get what they want. So I'm at that point right now where I'm saving like crazy. I don't have a lot of money to spend on wine, which really hurts me. So I've been cheap. I've been buying inexpensive wines all through the summer.
Okay, how inexpensive? I guess my question is, to you, the expert, how low can you really go?
How low can you go?
Yeah, I mean, without ending up with something undrinkable.
Well, I mean, I think that there are really delicious wines out there in that $6 to $10 range, but I've challenged myself to find wines that were not only drinkable, but insanely delicious, that were $6 or less, if you can believe that. And I found a bunch, and I want to share them with you.
You've got to be out of your mind, Josh.
They have corks. And they come in glass, not boxes, and they don't have straws, and they're really, really good. In fact, these are the kinds of wines that if you stick them in a bag and you pour them to your wine-savvy friends and you don't tell them how much these wines cost, you ask them to guess, they will always come up with $10, $11, $12, $13, $15. Then you reveal the price. I leave the stickers on just to show them that I'm not kidding. And it blows their mind every time.
Okay. Half of America has now pulled off the road and is tearing into the glove compartment for a pad of paper. We need the names desperately.
Well, you know, it's no coincidence that these wines come from fairly similar places. I'll go to Portugal first, because that to me is the land of impossibly delicious value. And the two wines that I'm going to recommend come from different places in Portugal. One's a white, one's a red, and they're both around $5 a bottle. The white wine is a Vinho Verde. And Vinho Verde is one of those white wines that's just silly and easy to drink, and it's got a little bit of fizz, and you don't take it seriously. They don't take it seriously over there. It's low in alcohol. And the wine that I'm going to suggest to you is by Famega, F-A-M-E-G-A. And it's $5 or $5.50. If somebody's charging a lot, they'll sell it for $5.99. And it's just an incredibly delicious white wine. And if I had to find a sort of a cousin, a kissing cousin in Portugal to that white, the J.P. Vinhos Tinto, which sells for all of $4.99 or $5.50, is just a crazy stunt double for a $10 or $15 red wine coming from a lot of other places. It's got structure. It's got some body. It's got tremendous cherry fruit. It's not just a watered-down red wine that you could drink because you can't afford anything else. It's really, really good. And it's all over the place, and I love it. And I can't recommend those two wines highly enough, but there are a couple of others, too. Right next door in Spain, probably the second best place to look for inexpensive wines. And this vast region in the middle of Spain that used to produce what the French call Planc, I don't know what the Spanish call it, Planca, La Mancha, has improved so dramatically in winemaking. It's a very hot, dry place. And the wines that came out of there were kind of flat and alcoholic and not particularly interesting. But there's some really good little producers, or in this case of the wine I'm going to recommend, a fairly big producer, Protocolo, P-R-O-T-O-C-O. I think I got it right. Four O's. It's $3.99 or $4.50 a bottle. I mean, if somebody's charging up, if they're committing aggressive larceny, it's $4.99. And this wine, every time I taste it, I can't figure out how they got so much goodness in this little bottle of wine. But it's just delicious. It does everything.
Is it a red or white?
It's a red.
Uh-huh.
They make a white, but the white isn't nearly as good as the red. If you have one red wine to buy for $5 or less, this is the wine to get, because it'll go with everything from burgers to steak to tuna fish salad. I mean, it's an impossibly good value. And there's a white wine from Chile, which I just stumbled upon. I mean, I literally stumbled upon it because there was a case in this wine store that I was shopping in, and I tripped over it, and I looked down, and I was really upset, and I saw this box, and it had a price on it, and it was $4.99 for Chardonnay, and it was a 2001 vintage. Oftentimes, you think they're selling wines for that little, they're getting rid of something that's old, but this was brand spanking new, and this wine was unoaked and easy to drink from Casona, C-A-S-O-N-A, and it came from the Central Valley in Chile, which is this giant, you know, area where they're growing tons of grapes. And, you know, it's one of those Chardonnays that's not manipulated. It didn't really taste like Chardonnay. It mm-hmm. just tasted like the best airline wine you've ever had. You know, I wish that I could put it into a little bottle with a screw top and then take it on, you know, the next JetBlue flight that I go on. Have you flown on JetBlue? It's really nice.
No, I haven't, but now I know the wine to take on board.
Exactly.
This is great.
Casona Chardonnay. Put it in a little bottle, put the screw top back on, you'll be very happy the whole flight.
Well, Josh, I hope you find the apartment, and and America thanks you for these names.
I will invite you as soon as I close on the deal.
You are on. Goodbye.
Bye.
Joshua Wesson is the creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can find his bargain wine picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Whenever I think wine, I think Mediterranean. And that leads me to our new web show, Tuesday Night Kitchen, because this week it's all about Mediterranean flavors. Now, Tuesday Night Kitchen, which you can only hear on the website, is where I get a chance to carry out one of my missions in life. I'd love to get you cooking for yourself. Easy stuff, you know, food that's fast and good. So every week I'm going to try to spark your imagination. Check it out. It's Tuesday Night Kitchen. Coming up, Gourmet magazine editor Ruth Reichel on eating out in America, the coffeehouse culture of Vienna, and open lines for your calls. Reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by Public Radio International. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. are what we eat and where we eat. With that in mind, Gourmet Magazine has taken an in-depth look at restaurants. They've done a guide to what they call America's best restaurants. And that's solely the upscale ones. They've included neighborhood places, too. And there's a collection of short takes called 100 Great Things About Restaurants. Think Coca-Cola Chicken in Thailand or a kid's peanut butter restaurant in Oregon. Gourmet's editor-in-chief, Ruth Reichel, joins us. Ruth, welcome.
Thank you. It's really great to be here.
You know, before getting into restaurants, how long has it been since you've taken over Gourmet Magazine?
It's about 3 years. It's amazing to me. It doesn't seem like that long. It seems like yesterday.
You've done this restaurant issue, kind of an overview of American restaurants. Well, what are you seeing? Where are restaurants heading at this point?
Well, the thing that's really interesting is this green market movement has really captured the hearts and souls of American chefs. And it doesn't matter where they are. That revolution that started in California, really, you know, in the 70s, has really now taken over all across the country. And the great restaurants are the ones that are using really fresh ingredients and cooking very simply.
Are we dining out differently?
Well, the big change that I've seen in the last year is that you see a lot more kids in restaurants. You really see people taking their families with them. I think that's a change since September 11th. That kind of, leave your kids at home. We don't want to be bothered by them.
Mm-hmm.
Has really changed. And certainly, you know, the thing that's always characterized Americans as, you know, compared to Europeans, is our openness and our willingness to try everything. And I see that really expanding. You see a real change in the kind of ethnic restaurants and the people who are going to them, that they're becoming more and more authentic.
What are the influences? I mean, is Mediterranean still big? Is Latin American the coming thing?
Well, Mediterranean has become so entrenched that I don't think anyone even uses the term anymore, because it's, you know, nobody's proud of serving olive oil. Everybody does. And, I mean, the terms that you're hearing now, I mean, Latin American is certainly coming in more and more strongly. You know, Nuevo Latino, you're seeing more chiles, more of the roots, the atillas, where you'll see taro fries on a menu that has nothing to do with Latino food. And certainly the Asian influences are, I mean, my own belief is that once you've sort of had soy sauce and garlic, you're not ready to let it go. And that influence is becoming stronger and stronger and stronger in all of our food.
Ruth, one of my favorite parts of this issue is the 100 great things about restaurants. Can you give us some of the highlights?
Well, this is one of my favorite parts of this, too. This was so much fun. And we just asked our correspondents all over the world to send us, you know, fun places, weird places. So there are things like a place in Portland, Oregon that's called Peanut Butter and Ellie's. That's a kid's restaurant. There's a place in Peru that you actually, it's right by an archaeological dig. So you're sitting in the middle of this dig eating dinner. There are places in gas stations and a place in England that serves sardine ice cream. One of my favorites.
Hey, cream and sardines, it probably works.
Oh, I don't know. It's a hard one. I mean, how could you not try it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I wonder if you could only have two meals in the entire country, but they had to be in restaurants that most of us have never heard of, where would they be?
Would Ginza Sushiko in L.A. count?
Yeah, can you tell us a bit about it?
Ginza Sushiko is it's probably the most expensive restaurant in the country. The chef there, and I don't use this term lightly, is really an artist. He started very modestly. The first time I wandered into his restaurant, he was in this tiny little place in the middle of nowhere next to a Subway sandwich shop. And when I sort of sat down, he tried to convey to me that this meal was going to be very expensive. And, you know, when I sort of said, well, that's okay, he was embarrassed to say, well, I mean, like, lunch is going to cost you $150 just for you. And just, but he is a true sushi chef in the sense of he has a license for fugu, the poison blowfish. And in fugu season, he flies to Tokyo once a week to get his own fugu. It's a sushi bar where you cannot see anything. He gives you the food bit by bit, but every single thing that he gives you is about the best thing you've ever tasted.
Have you actually had the fugu, Ruth?
Yes, I have. I have to tell you, in my opinion, fugu is not worth all the fuss. I mean, it's
and not worth dying for.
Certainly not worth dying for.
What would be your second place that you'd want us to go to?
Well, this is on the complete opposite end of the spectrum. It's the barbecue place in Luling, Texas. It's a town. Luling is this little town off the freeway, halfway between Houston and the Hill Country. And this is one of those places that's just a grocery store with a pit in the back. They only sell brisket and ribs and sausage. And you buy it by the pound, and they give it to you on white butcher paper. And then the white bread, all the white bread you can eat is free. And you carry it on the butcher paper to some picnic tables, which are in the store. They cook this brisket so that it is so soft and rich and tender that when you put it between the slices of bread, it just melts. Mm. And it's fabulous. And then you go and you buy pickles by the piece and some coleslaw. But to be there with a big group of your family is, you know, to me, one of the great restaurant experiences you can have in America.
Ruth, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Ruth Reichel is editor-in-chief of Gourmet Magazine. The restaurant issue is October 2002. The next time you grab an espresso to go at the local coffee house, consider this. There's a part of the world where to not sit and linger over your coffee is considered uncivilized. In the old Austro-Hungarian Empire, now I'm talking about the cities of Vienna, Budapest, and Prague, the coffee house was, and still is, the living room of the intelligentsia. Our guest, food authority Rick Rogers, has written the quintessential study of the coffee house. It's called Coffee House, Exquisite Desserts from the Classic Cafes of Vienna, Budapest, and Prague. Rick, welcome.
Hi, Lynn.
Rick, why were these coffee houses so important in the Austro-Hungarian Empire?
Well, the urbanization of the large cities happened very quickly, so there were a lot of tenements. People were extremely crowded in these new apartment buildings, so they needed some place that was comfortable for them to congregate, some place that was warm as well. And so the coffee houses were built as like little palaces. So with beautiful mirrors and very comfortable chairs so that people could really relax when they got there and get away from that day-to-day strife.
I see. So how did they play in the culture, though?
Well, this is where all of the poor artists and the writers and the theater directors and the actors and the actresses, before they, you know, established themselves,
yeah,
they were poor, they would be at the cafes gathering, exchanging ideas. You know, everybody from Trotsky to Richard Strauss had their own favorite coffee house. I don't mean to say that the coffee houses were only for the poor people.
Mm-hmm.
I just mean to say that they were for everybody.
Rick, why the emphasis on sweets in the coffee house?
With the Habsburgs, Emperor Franz Josef was a Habsburg. They were also the leaders of the Holy Roman Empire. And so they took Catholicism extremely seriously. So things like meatless Fridays and fasting on holy days and fasting during Lent was very, very, very serious. And so people were looking for meals that were meatless yet filled them up. So many of the things that we consider to be desserts, like strudels and cheesecakes and so forth, they originally started as a meal, something that people ate around 12 o'clock during the day, and it filled you up. So when you say, oh, this dessert is so heavy, it's supposed to be heavy. It's supposed to fill you up. As a matter of fact, the word for dessert in Viennese dialect is Mehlspeisen, which means a meal that is made out of flour.
Huh. You know what I'd love to do? I'd love for you to walk us through what it's like to go and have coffee at one of these coffee houses, let's say in Vienna.
You walk in and automatically you feel that you step back into another time. Just to look at the place, you will normally see authentic, not reproductions, of Thonet chairs, those gorgeous bentwood chairs. You're going to see coat racks that are made out of heavy, heavy wrought iron, because those winter coats can get pretty heavy. So you got to have a good heavy rack for them. The room is normally L-shaped with lots and lots of tall windows to let in as much light as possible for reading. One of the L-shaped areas may have a billiard table in it, because billiards were very, very popular. The other side would be where you have your coffee. You're going to see stacks and stacks of newspapers, because they want to encourage you to sit down, relax, read your favorite newspaper, read your favorite magazine. But even more important than the look of the place, it's the feel of the place, because it is not some place where you go and grab a cup of coffee. It is where you go to contemplate your life, to think about the new novel that you're writing. You know, you see very few cell phones and very few laptops in these cafes. It's quite interesting. In fact, a lot of the places have signs that say, no cell phones allowed.
Hmm. What about the serving of the coffee?
Oh, well, very much different than a cup of cardboard that we may get here. Your coffee is always served on a tray. Silver or aluminum, depending on how high up the ladder you are in the cafe scale. But you always get a glass of water with your coffee, and the very best places will perch a spoon upside down on top of the glass of water to show you how dexterous your waiter is. And if you're really, really lucky, if you're in a top class place, they're going to give you two glasses of water. Now, that is supposed to be so that the next time you come, they want to remind you to bring a friend so you can have a nice conversation, Mitch Schlug. But I think it's really because this way the waiter doesn't have to come back and fill your glass too often. And don't expect your check to be put down immediately. They will not bring your check until you ask for it. And then it's still going to take some time for them to bring it over to you.
So it's all about contemplation and leisure. Hey, Rick, thanks.
My pleasure, Lynn.
Rick Rogers is author of Coffee House, Exquisite Desserts from the Classic Cafes of Vienna, Budapest, and Prague. Now, Rick left us with his recipe for marble kugel cake. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. We are opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's get right to the phones. We've got Clayton on the line. So, Clayton, what do you want to talk about?
Wow, what a wonderful privilege to be on with the great Lynn Rosetta Casper.
Thank you, sir.
my question is about two strange things, lamb and Guinness Stout.
Ah, now what has brought this combination to mind for you?
Creativity and hours of probably watching The Iron Chef.
which has inspired many of us to try things we would never have dreamt of before.
Indeed, absolutely. Yeah. Let me tell you.
Okay.
I was thinking about how I could season the lamb, and then I wanted to make a sauce with a Guinness stout, and I didn't know whether I could use mushrooms or anything in it, or how I can actually bring the two flavors together, or I can use a beefsteak. But lamb, I've grown up with lamb. I love lamb.
I think that Guinness is big and full-flavored, but it has that sort of bitter edge to it.
Yes.
Right? And lamb has a wonderful richness to it. A couple of things occur to me. First of all, if you did something really simple, take a leg of lamb and roast it and baste it with the Guinness stout.
Okay.
Now let's elaborate a little bit. This is what I do, because the other thing about when you work with beers like Guinness or any of the big ales,
yeah,
a dried fruit with that is delicious. So let's play around. I'm making this up as I go along. Let's make big slits in a leg of lamb and into it put a combination of chopped garlic and dried apricots.
Uh-huh.
Wouldn't that be nice? And maybe some chopped up onion. Okay. And I'd slip that into the slits. All right.
Okay.
And then do a slow roast, like 325 degrees, and baste it with a cup or two of Guinness, and then keep basting it with the pan juices, and cook it in a shallow pan, because what you want to do is cook off almost all of that Guinness and leave behind just that tangy edge.
Right.
And then if you wanted to, what you would do is you take the lamb out of the pan, you'd get most of the fat out of the pan, but you have this sort of pan juice thing.
Yeah.
I chop up a few more dried apricots, throw it in there along with some extra Guinness and some broth, and I'd put it over two burners and really boil it until it gets thick, scraping up every bit of brown bit from the pan.
Wow.
So you play the apricots against the Guinness, and then slice the lamb and drizzle that over it.
Wow, that sounds fabulous.
Try it. And thanks for starting our imaginations off.
Thank you, gladly.
Take care.
You too.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, this week's question is, how do coffee and dancing relate? We're going to have that answer in a moment and more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table, produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed by PRI. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. We're going to be back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, how do coffee and dancing relate? The answer is the waltz. Now, let me back up a bit. This relates to the interview we did with Rick Rogers on the Viennese Coffee House. Big city audiences first danced to the waltz at Vienna coffee houses in the early 1800s. And yes, Johann Strauss was one of the musicians who introduced it. Now, considering how we dance now, it's kind of hard to get into the mindset of that time. The waltz was pure scandal between caffeine highs and the first time that proper men and women could dance in each other's arms in public. These were wild goings-on. Now, there's another coffee music connection. Remember the coffee cantata by Bach? Well, this was protest music. He wrote it in 1732 to mock a medical campaign to discredit coffee in Germany.
Perhaps Beck should take on Starbucks. Okay, back to the phones. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Okay, let's see. Who's up? We've got Allison on the line. So, Allison, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have a vague dream that it occurred to me that you might be able to give me advice for.
Yeah.
I would really love to be a food critic.
Oh, boy. You don't want to make a lot of friends, do you? So what inspired this?
Well, it's funny. Ever since I was even in high school, which I'm 24, it's literally, I have such an attitude toward food. You know, I've always kind of been notorious for being very picky, very choosy, very, you know, my friends love going out to eat with me because they say it's just an absolute experience. And people who know me very well just say I have the writing skills for it, that I am able to describe things well. And I think that's just, I have a real passion for food, and it's not for cooking it, but I love talking about it.
I understand. You know, there's some of the greatest experts have never walked into a kitchen.
That's good to hear.
No, but it's true, because there's so much expertise that you could apply in so many different ways. So you want to know how to get started as a food critic.
Right. I have absolutely no idea how to go about that.
One way, and this is the way a lot of people get started, is writing for a local newspaper.
Okay.
It may be, you know, I'd say, I always believe you start at the top. Go after the most popular paper in your area and say, you know, I really would like to do some restaurant criticism. Could I bring in some columns that I've done myself? Show them some samples.
Okay.
Do some trial columns. And then if they say we want people with more experience, I would go to the weekly papers or the alternate presses and that kind of thing and start there. Because the whole point is get yourself into print any way that you can, and then you start to build from there. And I guess the other thing, but you're already doing it, is educating yourself on everything and anything you can think of.
Okay.
About food, you know, food from different countries, things that you think work or don't work. The thing about being a great critic, I think, is you think of your palate the way an athlete thinks of their body. You must keep it toned and in shape and beautifully exercised. You want a buff palate. That's the basic idea. and so keep exercising that palate on things that intrigue you or things you don't know about that you want to understand more about.
Okay.
Yeah, but I would say start with the most popular paper, you know, the biggest paper in your area, and then work backwards. And then from newspapers, once you start getting your, you know, your sea legs on that, and you start building up, you know, some clippings that you can show people, start approaching magazines.
Okay.
Or the other place that's great to start is on the web.
Right.
Search for restaurant criticisms on the web.
Okay.
You know, see, because there's not a lot of money to be made in either one of these venues, but it's a beginning for you. That's how you begin to establish a reputation.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah. And good luck.
Well, thank you so much.
You are welcome.
Okay.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see now, who's up? We've got Lori on the line. Lori, hi. What's up? What is on your mind?
I have a question for you about Swiss chard.
Oh, okay. All right.
I'm trying to think of some other things to do with it because the stuff grows for a very long time. It starts very early in the year. It's very prolific. And by August, I'm so tired of it, I'm ready to dig the plants up.
It's sort of the zucchini of the green world, isn't it?
It really is.
It keeps producing. My Tuscan grandmother used it all the time. Tuscans love greens, at least my family did. She'd steam or boil both the stems and the leaves. She would chop them up. She'd mix them with egg yolk, a ton of Parmesan cheese, toasted breadcrumbs, garlic, and I think some herbs, and salt and pepper.
Uh-huh.
And then she'd pan fry that in little patties, and they would.
Okay, so it's almost like an egg foo young thing.
Well, kind of like that, you know, or like a veggie burger.
Oh, Oh, okay. So
and it was like a half inch
to
thick.
Hold it together?
That's right. And a half inch thick, and the cheese would get melty. I mean, it would hold together. Mm-hmm. But it was like a half inch thick, so the egg cooked all the way through. And sometimes she threw a little pinch of hot pepper in it. There was often basil in it. Sometimes it was a tiny bit of chopped tomato. She once put chickpeas in it. And the idea was it was crisp on the outside. She did it, you know, she did like a half inch of olive oil. Mm-hmm. And sometimes she even breaded the outside, but sometimes she just did it plain. So you got crisp fried bits on the outside and this really delicious inside.
Oh, that sounds really
good. This could really change everything forever. I mean, you may never want to make Swiss chard any other way.
Yeah, I'll try that.
Okay. Hey.
Okay, thanks a lot.
Thank you. See, there you have something else. I mean, you know, they talk about people grow so much zucchini, they leave baskets of it late at night on their neighbors' porches. We're going to end up doing that with Swiss chard one of these days. It's great in soup, too. Healthy? I can't tell you how healthy it is. Tastes really sweet. Anyway, call us, 800-537-5252. We have Kate on the line. So, Kate, what's up? What do you want to talk about?
Hi. I have a question about copper cookware.
Uh-huh.
I just recently got married, and for a wedding gift, we received some copper cookware that I think is stainless steel lined.
Yeah, yeah.
And then we went on our honeymoon to Italy, and my husband fell in love with some handmade copper cookware that's tin lined.
You have a wealth of good stuff there, woman. This sounds great.
Well, the only problem is we're somewhat afraid to use it because we have an electric range in our house.
Uh-huh.
And we were at a store in New York City, and they had a big handwritten sign next to their display of copper cookware not to use it on electric ranges. And we're not sure if it's a difference between stainless steel lining and tin lining or just in general.
Okay, let me explain. I'm not sure why they put that up there because I've used my copper on both gas and stainless steel. But here's the thing you have to know about using copper. It conducts heat very well, so it tends to get hotter sometimes be very responsive to heat. Never put any pan, but especially one that is tin lined, on a hot burner empty. You always want, whether it's a little liquid, a little fat, you always want that in it. The other thing is tin will melt at a very high temperature. And generally you're okay, but generally because both kinds of pans, you know, the stainless steel lined and the tin lined, will conduct heat so well, you generally don't need to go much higher than medium high to get the pan extremely hot. You know, if you want to do a fast saute or whatever.
Oh, okay.
And you just never put that empty pan onto a hot burner. And if you remember that, you should be in very good shape. I don't think that there's any problem in using it on an electric burner. I've used it. But I do have one question. Do these have brass handles or iron handles?
Oh, I don't know. I think some of them have brass handles.
If they look like they're yellow metal, that's brass.
Uh-huh.
And if it's black metal, it's probably iron. Now, the brass can get really hot. So what I want you to just be cautious about is that when you handle that pan, always have a hot pad or something to shield your hand from it. Okay?
Oh, okay, great.
The iron handles tend to stay a bit cooler. So what I want you to do is heat the pan gradually with always something in it. You know, that usually the fat that's called for in a recipe is going to be plenty, or some liquid. But enjoy them. You have beautiful cookware. And the tin is the softer of the two linings, and that might wear if you scratch it a lot. So you want to use wooden utensils. The stainless steel, I've had my stainless steel stuff 20 years, and you can't beat it to death. It's great stuff. And you're going to pass this on to your children.
I hope so.
What a great way to begin a married life. You're going to have pans that are going to last as long as your marriage. And may they both last an extraordinarily long time with great joy. Hey,
well,
thanks
thank
a
you.
Lot.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Reach us at 800-537-5252. We've got Jennifer on the line. So, Jennifer, what do you want to talk about?
I am a very amateur canner. Usually I just, when I have extra things from my small vegetable garden, I stick them in some bottles and hope that they come out okay. And usually that's tomatoes, which I haven't screwed up yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I had some extra green beans about a month ago.
Right.
And so I called up a friend who does more canning than I do.
Uh-huh.
And I don't have a pressure cooker, so I just you know, put it in the hot water bath or stew them before I put them in the bottles. So I didn't know how to do green beans. So I called her and she read out of her canning book. She said, blanch them first and give me a temperature and a time. And so I blanched them. And then, let's see here, put the boiling water in, put the lids on, and then put them in the water bath for about 20 minutes.
Right.
And I came out, and I didn't have that many green beans, so I came out with one pint. Okay, one pint of green beans.
It's a little bit of green beans.
It's my first pint, so I was very proud of them.
Right.
And so I told, next time I saw my mom, who's like the expert canner, I was like, guess what I did? Green beans. And she's like, oh, that's cool. Did you use your pressure cooker? And I'm all, huh? I don't have a pressure cooker. And she's all, she totally freaks out. And she's like, you can't eat them because they've got salmonella and you'll die. So I have this lovely pint of green beans that I'm really proud of, but I don't want to, and I don't want to throw them out, but I don't want to die either. So what should I do?
Oh, the real problem could be botulism. And let me explain the reasoning.
Okay.
Botulism is out there. It's everywhere. It can be very harmful. You can't smell it, you can't see it, and you can't taste it, but it can kill you.
Okay.
And it develops best when all air is cut off. That's when the little beasts, you know, those little microbes or bacteria just go nuts and they have a great time.
Huh.
Now, if there's a lot of acid present, that stops them dead in their tracks.
And tomatoes have that acid.
Yeah, not all of them, but some of them do. But this is one of the reasons why people have you processing, tomatoes with a lot of heat and a lot of cooking to be on the safe side.
Right.
Or adding acid to them. But green beans don't have any acid.
Right.
You know, barely any. And I'm not sure, I know pressure canning is often recommended, and I think it's because you reach a very high temperature. But, sweetie, I don't think I'd eat the green beans.
Okay.
But let me make a suggestion. This is taking you down a completely different road.
Okay.
The freezer was invented for lovely green vegetables. Because most of the time when you can green vegetables the way you did with the green beans,
mm-hmm.
they're cooked to death.
Mm-hmm.
They're not really tasty.
Mm-hmm.
And you went to all the trouble to grow the blessed things.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what you can do is do that blanching. You know, you drop them in boiling water for a few minutes
mm-hmm.
and then put them in a bath of ice cubes.
Okay.
Just to stop that cooking and just, you know, set the color.
Right.
And then drain off all the water, put them in, you know, one of those zipper bags, you know, those real heavy-duty plastic bags, write what they are, write the date, and stick them in the freezer.
And for how long will they last in there?
I have been known to keep things in there for a solid year. Most people would say they're best after about 6 months you want to start thinking about using them.
Using them.
But they'll keep for a heck of a long time, and they're going to be so fresh-tasting, so dynamite-tasting, and also... We'll save you from any chance that we might lose you to a green bean that you tasted.
Which my guinea pigs would mourn.
Well, you know, it's just that, I am not an expert in canning, but I do know a little bit about what can do us harm. Let's not take any chances. It isn't worth it.
Okay, well, I appreciate your concern and your help.
Well, I appreciate your calling. Just think freezer.
Okay, thanks, Lynn.
Thank you, Jennifer.
Bye.
Writer Greg Stebbin raised an intriguing question in Men's Health magazine. He asked, can what you eat improve your sex life? Well, we have Greg on the phone. Greg, hello.
Hi there.
So, Greg, tell me, what did you find out about the man who wants to attract a woman?
Well, we actually found out something that was very surprising because it involves what I think most of us would regard as one of the most boring foods on earth, and that's celery. It's just not very exciting, but once you understand what celery can do for you, it suddenly becomes one of the most exciting foods there is on earth. Because I'm actually going to read you, paraphrase a quote from Dr. Alan Hirsch, who we quote in this article. He says, and this may only apply to men, because we're Men's Health, it didn't occur to us to ask if the same would be true for women, but let's hope that it is. He said, when you chew a stalk of celery, you release odor molecules into your mouth that then travel up the back of your throat to your nose. Once there, they boost your arousal and cause your body to send off scents and signals that make you more desirable to women. It takes effect immediately, so you should notice the women around you paying more attention to you right away.
I see every bar in America now having to deal with tons of requests for Bloody Marys.
Well, yeah, isn't that interesting? And what's the other thing that you always get at happy hour is buffalo wings, and what's always in the dish next to them that nobody eats?
The celery.
So it suddenly all makes sense.
Okay, now you've got the girl, and we're alone together, right? Yep. And I guess for lack of a better word, anything to help performance.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a country full of listeners who are on the edge of their seats. They need examples right now.
Well, let's give them those examples. Some of these foods, by the way, or most of them, are actually foods that we all love to eat anyway. For instance, vanilla ice cream and dark chocolate.
Uh-huh.
Everyone loves ice cream and chocolate. Well, let me tell you what those two foods do. The first is any ice cream that you eat will be rich in calcium and phosphorus. And what those two minerals do is, first of all, they build up your body's muscle reserves and can literally boost a man's libido. Now, vanilla is interesting. If you have vanilla ice cream, the scent of vanilla will relax you. It may actually reduce any anxiety that you have from your life that you're taking into a sexual encounter and could actually reduce any inhibitions you may feel. And chocolate is a little different. Chocolate actually contains stimulants, so the vanilla relaxes you, but chocolate contains stimulants that can literally increase your body's sensitivity. So again, as I was saying before, it juices up your nervous system. You now, when you get touched, you feel it in a way, in a more pleasurable way than perhaps you've ever felt it before. And the other thing that's interesting about chocolate is that, and I think women have always instinctively known this, it contains chemicals that can literally promote a feeling in you that is similar to the sensations you might feel when you first fall in love.
Well, chocolate bar next to the bed, ice cream in the freezer.
That's right.
And celery in the refrigerator.
That's right.
Thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you.
Greg Stebbin writes for Men's Health magazine. The article on sex and food appeared in the October 2002 issue. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks, everybody, for joining us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. So until next week, let me leave you with this thought from the one and only Julia Child. Life itself is a proper binge. You can find everything you need on our website. That address is splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out the Splendid Table store. It's full of the things I like to have in my kitchen. Well, truthfully, some of the things that I like to have in my kitchen. Anyway, all the proceeds go to support the program. Also, while you're there, for no investment whatsoever, you can try out our new web show, Tuesday Night Kitchen. You can hear it only on the site, and it's dedicated to making your weeknight eating a little easier and a little bit more fun. There's a new one every Tuesday. Get it? It's Tuesday Night Kitchen. Anyway, it's all at splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with help from Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. The Splendid Table is produced by Minnesota Public Radio and distributed nationwide by Public Radio International. Have a great week and join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
PRI, Public Radio International.